Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to the August 10th edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees. You know, sometimes shows just fall into place, and this week is one of those times. I have three great guests this evening, and if I can squeeze it in, I even have some interesting news. David Epstein is the senior writer for Sports Illustrated. As many of you know, I often use the phrase, the bicycle gene, mostly as a tongue-in-cheek comment about how passionate some of my guests are about cycling. But earlier this week, I heard an interview with David on NPR's Fresh Air about his new book, The Sports Gene. And as Yoda would say, jump on it, I did. Is there a connection between genetics and athleticism? Or is environment and diligent practice what makes a great athlete? David searched and researched answers to these questions, and telling some fascinating stories in the book comes to what may be some surprising conclusions. In addition, David has been a go-to source for a lot of commentary on Lance Armstrong, and I figured we might be able to connect some of the concepts in the book to what makes Lance tick. We'll talk to David in a moment. After some noodling around with the tour of Utah press folks, I was utterly and delightfully surprised to be able to speak with Sean Whitey, press officer of BMC Racing. Now, this interview was recorded on Thursday, so the results you hear will only be up to date then. But BMC's Greg Van Avermaet was in the Larry H. Miller Tour of Utah's leader jersey when we had our chat. Finally, I'll talk with Rob Greenfield. Rob is just back from a 4,700-mile cross-country trip on a Calfee bamboo bike. Rob has some amazing and insightful stories to share, and he's all about being off the grid. I would defy most of us to accomplish or even attempt to do what he has. I'd briefly like to mention that next week's show has been in the planning stages for many, many weeks, and I hope you'll join me then too. I'll be speaking with a panel of professional women cyclists, both in the Peloton today and having been on the podium in the past, about the state of women's cycling worldwide. There are a lot of issues and a lot of excitement, from equal pay to new sponsorship and events, and this will be the full hour of my show next week. So let's get right to it and welcome Sports Illustrated senior writer and author of The Sports Gene, David Epstein, to the show. David, thanks for joining me this evening. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
When I heard your interview on Fresh Air this week, I was delighted to learn about your new book, The Sports Gene, Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance. Would you give me a little background that led you to writing the book?
So there were sort of two separate streams that led to me writing the book. The first was just my own athletic experience, kind of three main points. One, there was a mini Jamaican diaspora to my hometown, Evanston, Illinois, in the 80s, and I grew up with a lot of Jamaican guys, and their enthusiasm for track and field made it a very popular sport at our high school, and we were very good, and we would basically kill everyone, and I would see how fast these guys were, and I just sort of started to wonder, you know, boy, what's going on in Jamaica? You know, did they bring some kind of speed gene over from the island? You know, and then I kept running, and I moved up in distance, as people often do when they go to college. And so now I'm running against Kenyan athletes. And, you know, I run the half mile, so it's like you travel to a meet, and you have tons of downtime to run for a very short time and
right.
Talk to the other runners. And I started to learn that not only were they Kenyan runners, but really they were all from one minority tribe. And I just started to get really curious about that. You know, and that... Those two things, in combination with the fact that one of the Jamaicans I ran with in high school dropped dead after a race, and it turned out to be from a genetic condition, those really got me interested both in sort of the nature, nurture, and overrepresentation of certain groups of people in sports, and also kind of the health aspect of it.
Wow, those three things would probably have gotten my attention too. So
yeah.
You wrote the book sort of as a series of stories that illustrate
yeah.
science and genetics and athletic prowess and all of that. Would you tell us the story of Jenny Finch? I loved it. It was so awesome.
So this is another, it just didn't go back as far for me as high school or college, but this made me really curious what was going on here. So Jenny Finch is a great softball pitcher. She's an Olympic gold medalist. And she was invited back in 2003 to a celebrity softball game with major league players. So she was the only softball player. She was supposed to be there just as like a ceremonial coach. And the guys, you know, figured that they could, you know, nail a couple home runs off her in exhibition practice. So they decided to hit against her. And it turns out they not only could they not hit her pitches, they couldn't even hit foul balls, much less home runs. You know, she's facing Albert Pujols, the best hitter of a generation, and he can't hit a foul ball. And so I started to wonder how that's possible, because Jenny Finch throws in the mid-60 miles per hour and from 43 feet, and so the ball takes the exact same amount of time to get to the hitter as does a mid-90s fastball. So
sure.
Totally routine for a major league player. And so I started to say, boy, you know, I thought these guys have these unbelievable reflexes. But if that's the case, it doesn't make sense that they're not reacting fast enough to a ball that's taking the same amount of time to get to them. And what it turns out is that they actually don't have any faster reaction times than any teacher, doctor, or lawyer. I mean, I scored faster on a visual reaction time test than Albert Pujols, which isn't even saying that much, because he only scored in the 66th percentile compared to a bunch of college students. But it turns out that the minimum human reaction time is about a fifth of a second to initiate muscular action, and that's half the flight time of a major league fastball. So you literally cannot react fast enough to hit a fastball unless you're using learned perceptual cues from the pitcher's body and from things like the flicker of the ball, which is the flashing pattern that the seams make when the ball rotates. And these guys, through lots of practice, have learned how to, well, unconsciously pick up on these cues, like the shoulder movement of the pitcher, to predict the future, to predict where the ball's going in the future. And when they're faced with a pitcher who has an unfamiliar, who's throwing underhand, has an unfamiliar shoulder motion, the ball rotates in an unfamiliar way, they can't hit it. They're just like you and I. They're stripped of the learning that allowed them to seem like they have faster reflexes.
So it wasn't necessarily a genetic or predisposition to being able to quickly react and hit the ball. It was actually a learned process. Interesting.
That's right. Their reaction times, baseball players, when they're tested over and over, are totally on par with if you take random people off the street and test them.
Wow. Who would have thought? Well, you always heard, keep your eye on the ball, keep your eye on the ball. But in fact, that's not what you're saying. There are a lot of other factors in there.
Keeping your eye on the ball is actually literally impossible.
Right.
As the ball gets, you can
exactly.
Look at the ball when it's out of the pitcher's hand, but as it gets closer, its angle to your eye is changing so quickly that you can't actually track it. So a hitter could actually close his eyes when the ball's halfway to home, and it wouldn't make any difference, if it wouldn't be psychologically upsetting.
Wow, that's really cool. Your whole book has some great stories, but the one about Jenny Finch just cracked me up, because I love baseball. Anyway, you talk about the 10,000 hours. Everybody talks about, well, if you do something for 10,000 hours, if you practice something for 10,000 mm-hmm. hours, you can become an expert or a professional. But it doesn't really work like that. How come?
That's right. So the 10,000 hours came from originally from a study of violinists, from a tiny group of violinists who had already gained admission to a world-famous music academy. So first of all, this theory that has come to symbolize the idea that there's no such thing as talent, it's all just practice, came from a study of a group of people who were so highly pre-screened for their talent already that almost all of humanity had been already screened out. And then the top 10 of these violinists had accumulated about 10,000 hours of practice by the age of 20. That said, there was variation between them of over 500 hours. So the 10,000 hours was always just an average of individual differences, really. And so, for example, in my second chapter, I tell this story of two high jumpers, one who has about, by his estimate, 20,000 hours of practice, and the other is closer to zero. So they have an average of 10,000 hours between them, but that doesn't really tell you anything.
Right.
It was always an average of individual differences, and you know what we see now is that that's the only real rule, is that there's a huge range between individuals, and you really want to know the range, not the average. In chess, to get to master status, the average is 11,053 hours. But the range is from people who make it in 3,000 hours to people who are at 25,000 hours and haven't made it. So really, if you leave out the range, you're not accounting for individual differences in the possibility of talent.
So that's sort of Malcolm Gladwell's, didn't he do something about 10,000 hours? If you do something, well, I don't know.
He's the one that made it famous, the 10,000
okay.
hours rule, because he called it the 10,000 hours rule. K. Anders Ericsson, the psychologist who did the violin study, never called it a rule.
I see.
In fact, Erickson you know, in his study, the violinists reached 10,000 hours around age 20. They actually were much higher by the time they were at their peak. But Gladwell actually does sort of give a passing mention, saying, "Well, of course, these people are also talented." But if that's the case, then what is this rule? What good is it? You're just saying practice and hard practice matters. That was never controversial. Like, we know that.
Right, exactly. Practice makes perfect. That's what, of course, even that's not true. We've sequenced the human genome, and this is getting into sort of the genetic possibilities. There's a lot of complicated stuff that really doesn't lead to a clear picture of whether there's a connection between genetics and athleticism. So what are some of the factors that might lead to a star athlete like an Alex Rodriguez? Or we will eventually talk about our buddy Lance, but go ahead.
Well, of course. Yeah, so a decade ago when the human genome was sequenced, scientists sort of hoped that it would be simple, like there'd be one gene that tells you about your height and one gene that tells you about the shape of your nose, and it's turned out to be much more complicated. Not only are many genes involved in any individual trait, but the genes interact with one another, and they also interact with the environment. So really, what medical genetics showed us that, for example, because you and I probably have different versions of a gene that's involved in acetaminophen metabolism, if I take one Tylenol, it may be more effective for me than one Tylenol is for you because of our unique genomes. And we're seeing the exact same thing in exercise and sports genetics, where in many cases the more important kind of talent is the ability, your biological setup that allows you to profit from training, maybe more or less than your training partner. And so taking genes and sort of isolating them and talking about them alone is, not really accurate and kind of confusing, because what exercise genetics is saying is that really what your genes interact with a training program, and to get the best result, you have a totally unique genome in the world, and so for optimal performance, you would want to have a totally unique environment and training plan that's catered to your genome. So really, the two are totally inextricable.
So when we look at people who hire coaches, for example, and they're saying they are tailoring a program to you. Are they really doing that? I mean, do you think they might be actually doing that because of some of these things?
Oh, I do. I don't think they're doing it because they're genetic testing, but I do think they're doing it intuitively. Like, I think they are sensing, for example, in football, of course, that happens kind of organically. Like, you take the guys who are kind of, big and plodding, and you put them on the line, and you train them with one guy, and you take the receivers who are fast and explosive, and you train them with another guy. But I think good coaches do that kind of intuitively. They may not be taking muscle biopsies of their athletes and seeing who's more fast twitch and who's slow twitch, although there is a Danish scientist I mentioned in the book who actually does do that,
right,
and then tailors training. But most of us aren't going to do that. But if we pay attention, we can probably guess at that information based on things like our vertical jump and our explosiveness and how good we are at different tasks. And I think good coaches start to pick up on that instead of just giving everyone the same training plan and wondering why it's working for one person, not the other, right? Like, anyone who's ever been in a training group, cycling, running, whatever, you can do the same exact training as five of your peers, and you're not going to cross the line at the same time.
Right.
You know, in many cases, you'll become even more different. So I think really good coaches pick up on that in individualized training. And I know in, like, special forces, for example, in the military, they get to the point where, these are like the elite of the elite. They get to the point where they have their own individual coaches. So it's literally one-on-one coaching, and that's something they prize. And I think that's really great.
I'm speaking with David Epstein. He is the senior writer at Sports Illustrated, and his new book, The Sports Gene, Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance, is what we're talking about. You talk about Claude Bouchard and his heritage studies. What were the heritage studies?
The heritage study was it was a group, so a consortium of five universities came together and enlisted about 100 two-generation families who did not have training background, and they spread them among four different university sites and had the families over 5 months come in several times a week and do cycling training, and it was perfectly controlled. Like, there was 100% compliance. The families had to come in and do it in the lab. And what they found was that in all four of the study sites, they saw this spectrum of improvement in VO2 max, or aerobic capacity, which, of course, the amount of oxygen you can use when you exercise, which is not the only factor of endurance, but a powerful one, powerful predictive factor. And at all four centers, there were about 15% of participants who didn't improve at all after 5 months of training in their aerobic capacity, and 15% who improved at 50% or more doing the exact same training. Hmm. And it turned out that families really sort of stuck together, more or less, on this improvement curve, as did identical twins, very stuck right together.
Right.
In 2011, the group found a genetic predictor set, 21 genes, that account for a substantial portion of one person's ability to improve from the training next to someone else's. And it had nothing to do with how good someone is to start. So some people came in terrible shape and had huge gains. Some people came in terrible shape and had no gains. And some people came in better aerobic shape and just naturally and had very few gains. And so, again, this was this probably the most famous exercise genetics study ever and led, sort of opened the floodgates to this idea that the most important kind of talent in some sports is actually your set allows you to benefit from training.
I'm telling you, every chapter of this book is really interesting, and the stories are awesome. And this is a story. All right, now this one kind of blew me away because I vaguely remember something about this. You write about a Spanish athlete, and her name is Maria Jose Martinez Patino. And she was at the World University Games in 85 in Kobe, and they tested her, and she tested positive for testosterone, and it just took her life away from her pretty much. So she paid to have doctors test her. She discovered she had testes, but her body wasn't sensitive to testosterone. What does that mean? Her body isn't sensitive to testosterone?
So what she actually tested positive for was a Y chromosome.
Ah.
So they found that she had male chromosomes and said, okay, well, you're out. They stripped her of her Spanish national title and things like that. And then in follow-up, they found that she did have male levels of testosterone. So she was chromosomally male, but because of a problem with her, the androgen receptors, basically these receptors in your body that have to receive the hormone testosterone in order to cue all the things that then happen in your body.
Sure.
Because of testosterone, like muscle building, for example.
Mm-hmm.
The receptors weren't receiving the testosterone correctly, so testosterone was doing nothing in her body. So even though she had male levels of testosterone, it was completely useless. Like she, it was just circulating totally inertly. She might just as well have had no testosterone. So she was unfairly disqualified. They were saying, oh, you have male chromosomes and high levels of testosterone, but it wasn't functional. So she was a woman. She had internal testes, but phenotypically, her body was, otherwise she's completely female, and eventually she was reinstated into competition, but her career had already been ruined.
Sure. Very interesting. Just fascinating stuff. All right, there's a chapter of the book that, and you said that the book in some ways might be controversial, and it's titled We Are All Black, Sort Of.
Yeah.
Which discusses race and genetics. Yeah. So what is that connection? What are you saying here?
So what that chapter is about genetic diversity. And what I meant by saying we are all black, sort of, is obviously some of us are white, so I had to put a sort of. But
right.
I meant that our genes trace back to Africa in the very recent past. So for a very long time, humans and the ancestors of humans were in Africa only, not in the rest of the world. And accumulating genetic adaptation, genetic mutations and adaptations, and our genes were changing. And so all this genetic variation built up in Africa. And then not so long ago, on the evolutionary timescale of things, a tiny group of people from East or Central Africa left out of East Africa. Tiny group, maybe as few as 100 people, or a couple hundred people, and then started populating the rest of the world. They mixed a little bit with Neanderthals, just a little bit, so all of us outside of Africa have a little bit of Neanderthal DNA. And then every time they spread to a new area, they took just a little subset of that population and moved forward. So you had a subset that left Africa, a tiny subset, and then tiny subsets from that subset that continued to move on. So really, you left almost all of the genetic variation in Africa. So if you got rid of everyone outside of Africa tomorrow, you would lose almost nothing from our gene pool. Like, all of our genetic variation is contained in Africa, with small exceptions, like the genes for white skin color and things like that. So really, in the truest sense, most of our genetic adaptations are all African, with very little having happened, in the recent past. Not to say some of the changes aren't important, but there's far, far more genetic diversity in Africa.
So if that's true, and we look at elite runners, we always think of African runners, Kenyans or Jamaicans in this case. Well, that they aren't African, but well, they are. But so why aren't we great runners like the Kenyans then?
Well, so the Kenyans specifically, so that's an interesting point, because we Americans think of Kenyans as being great marathoners. And when I went to Kenya, they think of the Kalenjin tribe as being the great marathoners.
That's true.
Runners.
You do say that.
not all Kenyans. And the Kalenjin are only about 10 to 12% of the population, and they have a couple things going for them. One is their ancestry is at extremely low latitude and in a very hot and dry climate, and what that causes is elongation of the body for cooling purposes, so long limbs compared to body size. And it's the same reason that your radiator has long coils. It's to increase the surface area to the volume so that the heat can get out. Same reason why you can tell an African elephant from an Asian elephant by the long floppy ears, to increase surface area for cooling. And that's great for running, because your leg is a pendulum, and when you have long, thin legs, it's way more energy efficient to swing them. So your running economy is way better. If you put 8 pounds on a runner's waist, it increases the energy it takes them to run about 4%. If you take that 8 pounds and put it in 2 4-pound weights at their ankles, it increases it 24%.
Wow.
So it's really important where you have the weight. And the Kalenjin tribe happened to be a very, what anthropologists call, elongated body type, or a linear body type. And so they have really good running economy. That, combined with the fact that they have sea-level ancestry, but they grow up at altitude, which means you're not genetically adapted to altitude, but then if you grow up there before adolescence, you have increased surface area of your lungs. And then they have, it's like the perfect storm.
I was just going to use that term.
Yeah. Then they have this environment where... There are no few distractions, and many of them grew up running to school, so they're already primed for training, used to running, have low body mass index already, and there's no opportunity cost for them to run. Like one of the Americans who made the Beijing Olympics marathon squad was putting off dental school to chase his running dream. Right? In rural Kenya, where many of the Kalenjin live, nobody's putting off school for running. They have no opportunity cost to try. So many people will go and try, literally show up at a dirt track and just try to run beside a gold medalist, you know, and a few of them survive, and the rest sort of slink back to their subsistence farms. So I think you have this great talent pool and then this unbelievable drive for a large number of people to try their hand at training.
So interesting. It's just fascinating stuff. Well, I want to talk a little bit about cycling. We do that on this show occasionally. So I watched some of the interviews you did, even on I think Sports Illustrated has its own sort of online video stuff.
Yep.
And you talk about Lance Armstrong. You've been following the story and putting aside his hubris and his sociopathic tendencies, if we could, do you think he was or is a genetically gifted athlete? I mean, how did he, even with EPO and everything else, accomplish this after what he went through with cancer, do you think?
Oh, I absolutely do think he was a genetically gifted athlete. I don't think he was, you know, when he was a young, sort of brash star triathlete.
Right.
I don't think he was doping at that point. And what's interesting is when he competed in the Tour in the years before, so it looks now, before he started doping, he was, you know, he was finishing, but he was kind of a non-factor. He didn't really have the physiological makeup that you would have thought would have worked for the Tour de France. It seemed like it would have been better sort of for shorter races at that
right.
time. So it seems to me like the doping sort of changed what he was good at, but I absolutely think he was a very, very talented athlete. I mean, I think doping can do a lot, but I don't think it can. I don't think it'll take you from nowhere to the Tour de France.
Okay, so you believe that drugs might enhance genetics, but do they cheat your genetics? Can they do the opposite? Can they actually harm your innate ability, do you think? And this, of course, is all speculation, I guess.
Oh no, that they can for some people. So it's well known actually. When I would talk to one of Lance's teammates, I remember, was telling me that the guys would always talk about, like I said, for Tylenol, they're high and low responders to any medicine. And EPO is a drug. So
right.
How your EPO receptor is structured genetically makes a difference to how good of a boost you get out of EPO. So guys won't respond. People always say, well, if everybody was doing it to level playing field. No, people don't respond to EPO the same way. They don't respond to any drug the same way. And some people get an over-thickening of their blood, which can actually reduce your athletic ability if it's too much.
That was the best explanation of how EPO works, just in general, that I've heard ever. Last thing, do you have a favorite story from your book that you'd like to share? Just a quick story?
One that I thought was really fun. So in the one of the chapters that surprised me the most in reporting was the one that discusses how variation in the dopamine system in the brain, the pleasure and reward system in the brain, causes some people to have like a compulsive drive to train.
Right.
And I didn't know that there was so much scientific evidence for that. And one of the people I profile in that chapter is Pam Reed, who's maybe the greatest female ultramarathon runner ever, or certainly one of the greatest. And she, when I interviewed her, she had just finished the U.S. Ironman Triathlon National Championships and qualified for the World Championships. And it was here in New York, and she was about to take a flight out of LaGuardia, but her flight was delayed, and she was literally running laps around the parking garage while I was interviewing her, because she says she gets really like antsy if she sits still. So if she has to wait, she runs around. I thought that was really neat. And
that
I
is
mentioned
neat.
That in the book.
She needs that, you know, that dopamine. She needs that push.
Yeah. You would think after having just finished the Ironman National Championships, you might want to sit still for a little while.
Might take
not
a break.
Pam Reed.
Well, I so appreciate you talking to me today. The book is The Sports Gene, Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance by David Epstein. David's a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. Join me from Brooklyn, right? New York?
That's right.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciated it. I enjoyed the book. I think my listeners will enjoy the book. Good luck with it.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
All right. Have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye. David Epstein joined me from his home in Brooklyn, New York, to talk about the sports gene. See, bicycle gene, sports gene. I always knew there was a connection. We're going to take a short break on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'll be right back.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if your day's routine is disrupted and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, be ready. Get a kit. Make a plan. Be informed. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
I'm Diane Lees, and we are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I think we have a few moments for news, and then we'll head on out to Saratoga Springs to talk with Rob Greenfield. My first story is one of those weird ones. It's from the Madison.com in Wisconsin by Bill Novak, a bicyclist who refused to use the bike lane in favor of a traffic lane on a busy east side street, was arrested after allegedly trying to kick a police officer who was trying to pull him over, police reported. Joseph Bailey, 18, from Madison, was tentatively charged with disorderly conduct and resisting arrest, according to a news release from Madison Police. It happened last Tuesday morning about 10:30 a.m. on Cottage Grove Road, and according to police, a bike lane along the curb was available, but Bailey chose to pedal in the right lane of traffic. Quote, passing motorists honked at the bicyclists, and he responded by giving them the finger, the police spokesman Joel Despain said. An officer on routine patrol saw what was going on and tried to get Bailey off to the side. He ignored the officer for a while, then eventually stopped in the middle of the road, Despain said. Bailey allegedly unleashed a barrage of expletives at the officer and also tried to kick him while being handcuffed. Well, there's a smart young man. I would think that maybe he should rethink kicking a police officer, regardless of where he was riding on the road. Last is about Ben Cerrada. I reported that Cerrada Cycles would close up shop for a while and that Ben said he'd be back. Well, this item came up in Brain this week, and it's titled Ben Cerrada Leaves Company, Owners to Seek Contract Work, which is kind of an interesting idea. Contract work is not exactly what Cerrada Cycles is thought of. You know, we're talking about these exquisite handmade bikes. So this is from the Brain staff from August 6th. Founder Ben Cerrada has left the company he founded 41 years ago, as has CEO Bill Watkins. The current owners of the Cerrada Bicycle Factory told Cerrada dealers in a letter this past weekend that they will be seeking contract frame building orders from other brands in order to support the future of the Cerrada brand. Brain obtained the letter, which was written by Brian Case, the chairman of Cerrada and a director of Divine Cycling Group, which was created earlier this year with the merger of Cirrata Blue Competitive Cycles and Mad Fiber. Ben Cirrata and Watkins told Brain last week that they were preparing to shut down the factory because of lack of funding from the new owners. Cirrata also told Brain that he was negotiating to extricate the Cirrata brand from DCG. DCG manager David Devine told the local Albany newspaper that the factory would reopen following a restructuring. So it goes on to explain what's going on that end. And then there was a letter that was written by Ben to Brain that explained exactly how he was fired from the company. So it's really kind of a sad, sad situation. And I hope to see Ben building bikes again soon. So that's the end of news for this week. We're going to head on over to Saratoga Springs, where Rob Greenfield is waiting to talk to us about his 4,700-mile bamboo bicycle trip across the United States. Rob, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
It's an honor to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you just completed an amazing trip, 4,700 miles on a Calfee bamboo off the grid. Why don't you tell us what that means?
Well, so it's not super simple, but I can try to sum it up in a couple of minutes. So the trip was called Off the Grid Across America, and what I did is I biked from San Francisco to Vermont, 4,700 miles, what I call living off the grid. And it actually is a trip of living as low impact of a lifestyle as possible. So the first rule was that there were five rules. The first one was that I could only use electricity that I created myself. So I had a couple of solar panels and basically didn't turn on a light switch, use a stove, microwave, anything of that sort for the entire trip. The second rule was that I could only use water from natural sources like lakes, rivers, streams, and wells, or water that was going to waste. So water from leaky faucets or fire hydrants or ice from the trays at a gas station that had gone to waste. Thirdly, I could only eat locally grown, organic, unpackaged food or food that would have gone to waste. So food from garbage cans, and or mostly dumpsters, actually.
Right.
And then the fourth rule was I could create, the idea was to create as almost no trash as possible. So I had to carry all the trash I created all the way across the country with me. And then lastly was to shop only at businesses that care about that practice corporate social responsibility and have an interest in using business as a medium to create a healthier planet.
So what prompted you to make this journey? What prompted you to put this particular package of rules together and head out on a 4,700-mile bike ride?
Well, some of it was kind of spur of the moment. It's just things just kind of came together. But the general idea was to come up with a creative means to inspire Americans to start living a healthier, happier lifestyle for themselves and in turn for the planet. So inspiring them to do simple things like drive less and bike more, eat local and organic food or food that's not packaged, conserve electricity and water. So I just used this trip and I used the bamboo Calfee bike as a medium to draw people into a story where they would learn and they would be inspired to start doing more for the planet.
So what is your background before you started this trip that you ended up, first of all, with the Calfee Bamboo, which is an awesome bike? You know, it's a great bike, and certainly it would draw a lot of attention. But what is your background that you decided you would bring to these people?
Well, I've been very, very into the environment since I was a child. I grew up catching frogs and fishing and playing in the woods. I grew up in a small town, and as soon as my mom would let me ride my bike out into the woods, that's where I was all the time. So I think maybe when I was maybe 6 or 7 years old, my mom gave me free rein and I could go out wherever I wanted, and I've always just had a passion for the beauty of the earth and the environment. And as a youth, it was just it was that thing where, like, if I saw another kid killing a frog, it was not cool in my mind.
Right.
And at that time, it was small things, and then as I got older, realizing that, and then traveling, I've traveled all over the world, 6 continents, and just seeing how beautiful and magnificent our world is, and just being out in nature has made me realize that we have to do our part to protect it if we want to see it this way for the rest of our lives, and for, if we have children, for their lives, and this comes down to protecting what we love.
So what was the most exciting part of your trip? Can you actually, like, peg something, or are there a couple of things, or?
The most exciting part of my trip, it's hard to pick anything exactly in particular, but in general, just being on the bike is just a wonderful, wonderful thing. I've always, any time that I'm down, if I just hop on the bike, my spirits are always lifted. So just in general, being out and about every single day on the bike was great. Crossing over the Sierra Nevadas, that was the first time I ever crossed a mountain range, and that was a really great accomplishment for me. And one thing I learned there is the cool thing about biking over mountains is all you have to do is take it one pedal at a time, and you'll eventually make it to the top, and then you've got a big, huge downhill ahead of you.
Well, and that's sort of what I want to talk about. Some of the stranger things you did while riding this bike, just unusual stuff. So your website is greenfieldadventures.org. And you did things like, you have on there how many miles you rode naked, how many miles you rode barefoot, how many miles you rode standing up. What is that all about? That's pretty cool stuff. But you actually statistically made those things apparent.
Yeah, well, it's all about finding creative ways to raise awareness and just draw people into the story and get them thinking about the environment. So the standing up, I biked across the state of Iowa, 375 miles, without my saddle. So the campaign was called Stand Up for Sustainability, and I was literally standing up for sustainability. And then I biked barefoot from Denver to Omaha, which was 675 miles, barefoot with some junky pedals I got at Community Cycles in Boulder, Colorado.
Okay.
And that idea, that was just to do something crazy, again, to draw people into the story. And I biked 7 miles naked through Nevada, and that was just fun. It's just, being on a bike is liberating, being naked is liberating, and when you combine the two together, it's even better.
So what did you take with you? One of the things that just boggled my mind was you traveled 4,700 miles and produced 2 pounds of trash. It's just really? How did you do that? But we'll get to that. What kind of things did you take with you besides the bike?
Okay. Well, let's see. I carried a Bob trailer.
Okay.
And definitely highly recommend the Bob trailer to any cyclist who has more stuff than they can fit in panniers. But I also would say I would recommend panniers over a trailer if you want to travel light. But what else I had was I had solar panels from Goal Zero. I had a water purifier. It's a Katadyn ceramic filter. I had a tent, a sleeping pad, a sleeping bag, a minimal amount of clothing, probably a handful of shirts, a couple of longer, like a long sleeve and a fleece, and then a pair of pants and 2 shorts. And then I had all my camera gear, which my cameraman carried for most of the journey until Boston. And so that was quite a bit because we were filming a documentary.
Okay.
And then my laptop, cell phone, miscellaneous things like a external hard drive. So this was by no means a minimalist trip because the idea was to raise awareness and have tools that would catch people's attention and to document the trip. So I also had a little mini camp stove that you put wood in, and a fair number of other things. My trailer was not light.
So were you sponsored? Were there people who jumped on board of this concept and sort of helped you out along the way?
Yeah, so I had about 10 product sponsors, and the whole idea of why I wanted to have sponsors was to support and promote sustainable businesses, businesses that are using their products to do better things for the world. And so I'm a big advocate of responsible consumption. One, consuming only what you need to, and then two, when you are consuming things, buying them from businesses that are doing things in a positive manner. So I networked with a bunch of sponsors. Craig Kelphy was one of them with his second company, which is Bamboo Cero.
Right.
And then Prana was my clothing sponsor. They're yoga and rock climbing, really great clothing. Some of their clothes are made out of old bottle caps, for example. And Goal Zero was the sponsor for solar. And then I had about 7 other sponsors as well.
I want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Rob Greenfield. He just finished a 4,700-mile trip from west to east, talking about sustainability and local, dealing with local people. I'm all into that. So the last thing I want to talk about, actually, is about, you have a list of goals and ambitions on your website, and some of them are tied to your age. Now, I don't usually ask people how old they are, but how old are you?
26 years old, and my birthday is in a couple of weeks. So
well, happy birthday from me first. So how are you doing with your list? I mean, anybody can go out and take a look at the website, greenfieldadventures.org, and see what some of these goals and ambitions are. They're awesome that you actually spent that kind of time thinking about it, planning it, and then tying it to some things with your age. So how are you doing?
Really good. And when I had made that list of goals, I didn't put all of the things I had already accomplished on there, which was probably a list almost as long. But
wow.
Yeah, some of the goals are coming along really well. And the reason I write all this stuff down is because then it's there, it's visible, and I can see it, and it makes it more likely for me to do it. And the reason I put it on my website where anybody can see it is because then I'm somewhat committed to doing them once I said I have. So it's kind of a way to hold myself accountable.
Sure.
A lot of the goals have been coming along. One of my goals is to travel to all 50 states. I've been to 48, just made it to Vermont, which was the 48th. Visit all 7 continents, which I've been to 6, so I just have to go to Antarctica. And the main reason I haven't been there yet is because I want to travel there over land. I don't want to just fly down to Argentina and then go. I want to actually either drive or ride a bike to Tierra del Fuego and then catch a boat to Antarctica from there.
Got it.
Bike across the country is one of them. I got that done. And then there's a whole bunch of other ones. Travel to 100 countries, which I've traveled to somewhere around 30. And then I definitely plan on sailing around the world at one point, but I'm going to save that until I'm a little older. Maybe if I've got a nice lady to come along with me, that'd be nice.
A little companionship.
Yep. Yeah, lots of traveling, but the whole idea is to use my travels as a means to raise awareness about sustainability and just in general, inspire Americans and inspire people in the world to start living a happier, healthier life for themselves and for the planet.
So I think when people hear stories like this, they say to themselves, how the hell does he support this? How do you continue to do these amazing adventures in terms of financing them, where you live normally when you're not having an adventure, what kind of family support you're getting? And if you don't mind my asking, how do you support your adventures?
Well, I'm actually really glad you asked that, because what it comes down to is being resourceful, understanding how to use your money, and paying attention to what you're spending it on. So I don't actually have a ton of money, and these trips actually don't cost a ton of money either. Some of the trips I do are actually really, really inexpensive. So I did a trip to, I recently did a trip called One Way to Cabo, No Money, Find a Way Home. So I bought a $75 one-way flight from San Diego to Cabo San Lucas, which is 1,050 miles, and I brought nothing but my passport and my cell phone and the clothes on my back, and I had to make it home, which I did without any money. I hitchhiked back to San Diego. It took me 50 hours on the road and 11 rides. And so there's an example of a trip that actually didn't involve using money whatsoever. But this trip, for example, I mean, really didn't cost much, because when you're biking, you have the occasional need for an inner tube or a tune-up, things like that. But biking across the country doesn't cost much money. Most of the food I ate was actually out of the dumpster, because I don't like to see food go to waste, and there's so much good quality food in there that it was like the same thing as going in the grocery store and buying it, but instead I walked around back and got it for free. And then I use couchsurfing.com and warmshowers.org, which are two awesome resources for being able to be hosted all across the country. Warm Showers is specifically for cyclists and completely changed my trip. I stayed with 15 hosts. So traveling is not expensive. And then on top of that, what I do is I rent out my apartment when I'm not there. So one of the things that holds people back the most is paying too much for their home or for their apartment. My apartment at home, when I'm gone, I rent out my room for more than I pay for it. So
cool.
It's my apartment is $1,600, and I can rent it out for about $2,300 when I'm not there, which means I actually make $700 a month on my apartment, and that $700 is enough to live on the road comfortably alone, which would mean when I'm living on the road, I make enough just off of renting out my apartment. So it's simple things like that that really make it possible for me to travel. And then on top of that, just learning to not, I don't have a car. I sold my car a year and a half ago because I found that I was spending a total of $7,000 a year on insurance, registration, maintenance, parking tickets, occasional speeding ticket, and gas.
Heavy foot, huh?
Yeah. So I decided to sell my car, and that is $7,000 a year. And think about what you can do with that. You can travel around the whole entire world and see 20 or 30 countries for $7,000.
Sure.
And so it's all about, again, just being resourceful, not spending money when you don't need to. Another thing is when you do good things, other people want to do good things for you as well.
So that's true.
Go out there and be good to your community, and your community is going to give back to you. And depend on your community. Let your community depend on you. And the resources are out there. So just share the resources with people, and you won't have to use money as much.
What's your next adventure?
I have a lot of adventures planned. One is that I really am looking forward to is called A Life of Waste. And in San Diego, I'm going to find a spot, and I'm going to walk there on probably a Monday morning with nothing but my shorts. And over a period of, say, maybe 2 weeks, I'm going to build a life out of nothing but waste. So I have to build my own little home. I have to eat from waste. I have to drink water that went to waste. And I'm going to write, and I have to find a notebook and a pen to write with and literally live off nothing but waste for 2 weeks and film a short documentary and open it up for people to come watch and learn about resourcefulness and all the great ways we can use things that are free and that are in the garbage or at thrift stores and things like that to live and be happy.
Well, you know what? I'm going to check back with you and see how your 2 weeks of waste went, but I really, really appreciate talking to you today. It was so much fun. You are one interesting guy, and I really enjoyed some of the things you had to say. I hope other people did too, and I'm sure they will. So it's greenfieldadventures.org. There's a lot out there. Take a look. Rob Greenfield, thank you so much for talking with me on the show this week.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure. And also, if you want to check out my Facebook page, it's facebook.com/RobJGreenfield, and that's where I post a lot of my stuff.
Very cool. We will put that on. We'll link it up to our Facebook page. Thanks so much, Rob. Enjoy Saratoga Springs.
All right.
All righty. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Rob Greenfield joined me from his little vacation spot in Saratoga Springs, where he got to see state number 48. Vermont is just a spitting distance from Saratoga. We're going to now head on over to Utah and talk with Sean Wadey, who is the press liaison for BMC out of Switzerland. They are in Utah racing the tour. Sean, thanks for joining me on the show.
You're welcome, Diane.
The Larry Miller Tour of Utah is underway. BMC's looking pretty good. How many team members are racing the event this year?
So this year, just like we had last year, we have seven, and we can actually enter eight riders. But we entered seven, and that number worked out for us last year when we won. And so far this year, we've held the yellow jersey for one day. So it's kind of the lucky seven riders of the BMC racing team.
Yeah, Tuesday, Greg Van Avermaet was very modest about his victory. It was 180 kilometers. It was the first stage. Tell us a little bit about him.
So Greg is a Belgian who has been a kind of a one-day classics specialist for us. He's really good in the uphill sprints. And the sprint on Tuesday on the opening stage was actually downhill. So he didn't think he had much of a chance, but he kind of changed up his tactics and went way before the sprint even started and actually held on to win. It was a really bold move, but it paid off for him, and he took the race lead on the first day.
That's really awesome. So he got a cowboy hat. I actually watched some of the coverage. It's so cute. He seemed to really enjoy his cowboy hat.
You know, he really did, and he talked about how he's going to give it to his girlfriend. It's the nice thing about the Larry H. Miller Tour of Utah is it really embraces the state and its heritage. And so every city that we go to, when they have these podium ceremonies, they kind of have a flavor of the city or area that we're in, and they bring that out through the award ceremony with some unique gifts.
So how do your riders like this tour? How do they like the terrain? And I know it's hugely high up there in the mountains. How are they doing? Do they enjoy it?
First of all, we love racing in America because that's where we're registered. We're a United States team. But the guys from Europe especially like America. And the Larry H. Miller Utah Tour of Utah is unique this year that it truly is a tour of Utah. It's starting in the southern part of Utah, and we're making our way toward Salt Lake City. The guys really love it. We stayed in the dorms down at Southern University, and as we work our way north, we're seeing just magnificent terrain, national parks, and just it's really Americana at its finest, and I think the Europeans are loving it.
Well, your team, BMC, seems to be having a really good season. You had 10 wins in the last 6 weeks, 20 wins for the season. What's giving your team such consistency this year?
We did have a down part at the Tour de France, and like you said, we've had some consistency. I think it just was a matter of bringing everything together and really finding that camaraderie that sometimes takes time to take hold. And once you get one win and two wins, it just starts building, and then the other guys that may be racing in Europe or somewhere else, they kind of catch the fever, and it becomes a snowball that you can't stop. And so we're hoping that snowball just keeps rolling and getting bigger and bigger and bigger because there's still a lot of season to go.
Well, yeah, and I was actually going to ask that, and that is that you are staying stateside, or a team is staying stateside here to race the USA Pro Challenge, too.
Yes, that's one of our favorite races, just like the Larry H. Miller Tour of Utah. It's in Colorado, and we'll have a similar squad there for a race that's very close to this one. It's a race where TJ Van Garderen finished second last year, and so he's really aiming to be on the top step of the podium. And after his win in May at the Amgen Tour of California, he's going to bring a lot of confidence into that race. And true cycling fans will know that the Tour de France was a tough one for him, but from what I understand, he's been training well and is ready to win the race in Colorado.
Well, we'll watch for that. So let me ask you a question about the bikes. You know, a lot of my listeners always ask me, are the riders racing stock bikes, or are they custom for each rider?
You know, every team has custom bikes for each rider. In the BMC racing team, we have a couple different bikes at our disposal, so they do have choices. But I can tell you that across the board in professional cycling, there is a minimum weight that a bike has to be. So in that sense, it is kind of a stock that, that everyone has to ride a bike that, that weighs the same or more. But the different kinds of BMCs that the guys can choose from on our team, like the Team Machine or the Impec, they can tailor it to what the course is. If it's going to be a flat race or a climbing race or a race where aerodynamics is really important, they have a lot of different choices of BMCs available to them.
Are they riding electronic shifting?
They are. The Shimano Di2 system is on all of our all of our BMCs, and it's really state of the art. I mean, I'm still being involved in cycling for more than 30 years. I'm still kind of trying to grasp the technology, but it's an amazing advancement.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's really cool stuff. My last question's a little more delicate. I know you need to get back to your team. They're on the road right now. But there's been so much controversy about cycling in the past few years and so much dissension about the UCI and the leadership. And, you know, it's Cookson and it's McQuaid. This week, there was some question as to whether USADA was going to be able to test foreign riders. And my question right now is, how rigorous has testing been at the Tour of Utah?
So the Tour of Utah is under the USADA jurisdiction. And I can tell you that the first day, 8 riders were tested. And in my professional experience in the sport, that's a lot. Normally, you might only see 3 or 5, with one of them being the stage winner, one of them being the race leader, maybe 1 or 2 randoms or a jersey classification winner. But to test 8 people shows just how rigorous and committed that the Larry H. Miller Tour of Utah is to having a clean race and making sure that all the competitors are abiding by the rules. It's really something that I think they should hang their hat on, and I know they do.
Well, that's good to hear. It's just been such a horrific kind of side story that's been kind of overshadowing how beautiful and wonderful cycling is, because I love watching it, and it's upsetting when everybody says, oh, everybody's cheating all the time. You know, it's just not like that. I don't believe
it. The sport is, you could say, it has a little bit of a dark cloud hovering over it, but we're hoping that the clouds break pretty soon and the sun shines through, and some of the great Americans, especially on our team, like Taylor Finney and TJ Van Garderen, Brent Bookwalter and Larry Warbass, that those guys become kind of the future names that people get used to saying when they think of professional cycling.
Well, I hope you're right. And I hope you have a lot of good luck, lots of podium finishes. And I appreciate you taking time to talk to me on the show today. Good luck here and at the USA Pro Challenge, too.
You're welcome, Diane. Thanks
All right.
for having me
Have
on.
A great day.
You too.
Sean Waite joined me as he's getting ready to head on to Payson, Utah for the, I guess it was the third stage when we did our interview. Well, what a show today. 3 great guests. I hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back next week with my special women's panel about pro racing. I hope you have a great week. Go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.